when I start reflecting, I find that okay, it's impermanent, it's unsatisfactory because you have pain, it's deteriorates and so on. But I don't see okay, it stinks if you don't wash up, but yeah, it's. Yeah. It's something really amazing.
Okay, yeah. The body is good. The body is amazing. Wow, the body. The body is... okay.
Cannot see the father.
Okay, yeah. That's a good question. So anyone want to answer that question for him? I don't want to answer. Does anyone else want to answer? Here we have one. Okay.
Answer.
Yeah. Yeah. Does anyone want to give an answer to that one? Who wants to give an answer? Is he right? Is the body really amazing and beautiful, or is he wrong, or is it half right, half wrong, or what do you think? Yeah.
I think Buddha said we take the foulness or the non-attractive as attractive. So that's why we see it as beautiful until we really age, and then we can see.
Yeah. That's true. That's what it says. Yeah.
Yeah, incontinence and the all that. Then we see the foulness.
Yeah. That's one good, very good answer. Yeah, straight from the suttas. Eileen quoting the suttas, it was very nice. So I really approve of that. Anyone else want to say anything about the foulness of the body? You know the Pali word for foulness of the body? Asubha. That's right. Exactly. Yes. Good. Is foulness the right word? Is it the right good translation for asubha? What do you think it means? Unattractiveness? Yeah, that's a bit different from foulness, maybe. Yeah. Foulness is kind of very strong. It's kind of terrible. But unattractive just means maybe the lack of attractiveness. Yeah. And this is interesting in Pali because in Pali you have the prefix A. It's like a negative prefix, yeah? It kind of negates the other quality, and it can mean two different things. The prefix A can either make the word negative, so it can mean from beautiful to foul, or it can just mean the lack of beauty. Yeah? So the A can actually, and that is called a privative prefix in English language, and it just means that you are taking away the actual beauty itself. It means lack of beauty, and that's quite different from foul, yeah? And remember the purpose of the asubha meditation is not actually to see the foulness of the body. The purpose is just to reduce the attachment to the body. That's the purpose. So you want to have more like a neutral feeling. You don't want to kind of be disgusted and want to go and vomit or anything like that, because that's going too far, you know. You just want to basically find that neutrality. And one of the kind of nice ways of doing that, because I think you had in Singapore, you had an exhibition a few years ago. It was a German Günther von Hagen, yeah, you know that one? Was it Body Worlds or whatever it was called? Yeah, and that was really, we had that in Perth as well. It was really cool because he had what he called plastination technique, whereby he took all the liquids out of the body. He injected the body with silicon, so the body was actually preserved. He took off all the skin. Yeah, and the body without the skin is not quite the same as the body with skin. It kind of looks different without skin. So take off all the skin, and you see the body as it is. And you're right, there are some amazing things with the body, but also the attractiveness is gone. If you saw a person without skin, you wouldn't be attracted to them in the same way as you see one with skin. And that's kind of the point. Yeah, the point is that the body, the skin is only a tiny fraction of the body. That most of the body is all the other stuff. And when you see that for what it is, you're not really attracted to it in the same way. Thank you. Thank you so much. You are very, very kind. Sadhu. Okay. That's good. Yeah, that's good. I apologize for kind of drinking tea in front of you all. I hope you... hope you're okay with that. You had tea already? Yeah, so did I. Yeah, but I have more. I have even more. Anyway, so that is, I think, the right way of thinking about it, is that when you take the skin off, actually, that attractiveness that you find is actually gone at that particular point. And one of the important points about the asubha, you should do it on your own body. Yeah. So you shouldn't, you don't have to do it on anyone else. Always start with your own body. But take the skin off your own body. And then straight away you lose some of your attachment to what is going on. But I would say for the vast majority of people, I would not really recommend a Sumo practice at all. Because, you know, you live an ordinary life, you kind of live in a relationship or whatever, and it's not going to work. Yeah, the two things are clashing with each other. If you live a celibate life, if you live by yourself, if you are alone and you're 100% committed to the Dhamma, I would say, great, then you can do it and it actually may actually work. But an ordinary life, it doesn't actually, there's too much conflict of interest, yeah, that makes it basically impossible to do the Asubha practice. So I wouldn't really, I wouldn't recommend that to most people. So, good, that's great, yeah, thank you for bringing that one up. Yeah, excellent. So, anyone else want to have a topic they want to bring up? You want to give another answer maybe? Yeah? Or,
Hi, Ajahn. How do you deal with like procrastination or laziness, be it in meditation or doing work? I just like find myself procrastinating a lot of times, yeah, and not getting to work, yeah, either in spiritual practice or in like work.
Okay. Yeah. So how do you deal with procrastination? Well, sometimes procrastination is good. Yeah, it's not always bad, and sometimes it's good to wait with things until it actually needs to be done. There was I remember reading about a management guru at UCLA, University of California, LA, and he was saying that you should never do anything until it's necessary because you're still collecting information, yeah? So a good manager waits to make the decision in the last moment because then he has maximum information to make the decision. So you should, sometimes a good procrastination is good. And doing things, so you have to kind of find that balance between not doing things too early and not leaving them too late. So that balance is always often good. You have to, I think sometimes one of the most important things in any thing when we want to change ourselves is that we have to find out why we're doing it. Why are you procrastinating? What is the reason for that? You have to look into your mind. What is it? There's something there that you find attractive about procrastinating. Yeah, you like it for some reason. One of the reasons is because you don't think what you're going to do is any fun. Yeah, that's one possibility. Yeah? You think that this job you have to do, whatever, it sounds boring, something else is more interesting. Yeah? So often what you have to do is just to ask yourself, well, maybe actually it isn't that boring. Maybe there's something interesting there in this job. Try to look for the positive in this thing that you have to do. Yeah, it's like meditation practice. It's always easy to put it off. But once you get into it, sometimes it's actually incredibly enjoyable. You feel peaceful, much better than being on your iPhone. Yeah, is that the iPhone? So it's, so this is kind of the thing. You have to kind of build up that positive view of what you're doing. And when you build it up, you are more likely to do it. And sometimes there's a very short-term satisfaction of doing something else, like going on the internet or doing, I don't know what people do on the internet anymore, but whatever they do on the internet, there's a kind of short-term satisfaction there. And the mind has this craving for some kind of short-term satisfaction. And that is very often why people procrastinate. So you have to, sometimes you have to stand back a little bit and you have to realize that this short-term satisfaction actually is only annoying. It doesn't really get me anywhere. And that's why you have to use like the technique I was talking about in my talk before. Instead of relying on your willpower, you have to use a bit of wisdom. And you have to take your telephone or whatever it is that distracts you. Give it to your, do you live with your parents or do you live with your, who do you live with? Do you live with somebody? Do you live by yourself? No? Live with the parents, okay, yeah. So you give it, if you can't switch it off, or it's too easy to switch back on again, give it to your mum and say, Mum, put it somewhere, don't want to know where it is, give it back to me tomorrow morning or something like that, yeah? And then you don't get distracted by these things. Sometimes you need kind of very clear kind of things like that to be able to keep you on track. You have to be wise about your own limitations. Willpower is very weak. If the phone is there, you're going to use it. That kind of thing. So little things like that. So just try to be wise about things. Try to stand back and think about it. Wait a minute, what should I really do here? And then you may find a solution to your problem. Yeah. But a bit of procrastination is okay, yeah? Don't be too strict on yourself. Find the middle way, yeah? Middle way is everything. The Buddha's middle way. Majjhima Patipada.
Hi, Ajahn. Thanks for your sharing tonight. I enjoy it.
Yeah.
I was just wondering about your talk earlier on
regarding,
like, as a fellow Buddhist here, we practice this to attain what we want to be or where we want to be. And then my question is, does this practice or the spiritual development that we have attained in this life, at least we experience this life, nobody knows about next life, does it actually carry it to the next life? And if so, does that mean that we continue to be Buddhists in our many, many lives that comes? Or if not, if we become a Christian, for example, does it mean that everything goes to ground zero? Thanks.
No, remember what you are doing is you're developing your mind, yeah. And the thing that you take with you from one life to the next one is your mind. That's what you're taking with you. So if you develop your mind, if you change your habits in this life, you actually take that with you into your next life because your mind has changed. You're bringing the new mind. If you have more metta, more kindness for people, you take it with you. The body you have to leave behind, but the mind is what goes with you. So you have that mind when you go to the next life, but there's no guarantee that you will become a Buddhist. But you have that mind regardless. So how you use that mind is a different thing. If there still is Buddhism around, it is very likely if you know your suttas well, you know the word of the Buddha well, you will recognize it when you get reborn. Yeah, you think, wait a minute, I heard this way somewhere before. It's like me. I often ask myself, how come I'm a monk? Yeah, I was born in this ice cold country. And my parents weren't. No, I didn't know anyone who was Buddhist. I didn't know anyone from Asia. I didn't know anything at all. And for somehow, I'm kind of attracted to kind of travel to Asia. And I look at the Buddha. Wait a minute, something familiar with this Buddhist stuff, yeah? And becoming a monk for me was just very natural. It just kind of happened. And I remember when I was 12 years old, I had this fantasy of becoming a monk. Not become a monk, but living by myself in a cutie in the forest, yeah? So it's very often I think that these things are almost automatic. They almost happen. So when you get reborn, the most important thing that you should do in this life to recognize the Dhamma in your future life is to really understand the word of the Buddha. Don't just read books by other people. Actually read suttas. Because it is the suttas, it is the word of the Buddha that carries on in the world. Yeah, if you the idiosyncratic teachings of individual Buddhist monks or nuns or lay people, whoever they are, they kind of are around for a while and they disappear again. But the word of the Buddha is the one that carries on through 2,500 years. It's always there. So the better you understand the word of the Buddha, that is what you're going to be able to recognize in your future life, not the teachings of Ajahn Brahm, yeah? Good, bad, who knows? I'm not saying anything bad about Ajahn Brahm's teachings are great, they're really good, but they're not going to last in the same way that the word of the Buddha is my point, yeah? I'm not putting down my own teacher, that would be terrible. I'm not doing that. I'm just making a point, a bigger picture point here. So this is one of the reasons why, studying the word of the Buddha is good. So then you get reborn. If there is Buddhism around, you are likely to carry on. But there's no guarantee. If there's no Buddhism around, you know, what are you going to do? You're going to think, Christianity, Islam, what should I choose? There's always going to be religions like Christianity and Islam around because the idea of a creator God is very strong. It's kind of almost an automatic reaction to who we are as people. We believe in creator God. This always existed, yeah, this kind of teachings. It existed in India before the time of the Buddha. It's very much part of the part and parcel of things. Does anyone else want to answer her question? Anyone else have any experience with that? Anyone else who can remember their past life and who can say something about this? And actually, that's a good question. Can anyone here remember their past life? No? That would be really cool. Please raise a hand if you do. Very interesting. Okay. Okay, well, that's a shame. Anyway, we tried.
Ajahn Brahmani, do you remember your past life?
Right, yeah. You know the answer to that one, yeah?
I'm being naughty.
Ajahn, it's very, very nice hearing from you. I feel uplifted.
Yeah.
Recently, I got recommitted to get to know Buddhism again. I noticed it's very hard. Buddhism path is very hard because it's all about your individual efforts. And let's say for myself, I'm a lay person, then I'm always circling at this base level. Then I see yourself, Venerable, a full practitioner, but you still have somewhere to I think so. Some way to go. It's very difficult. Because I think the Buddha can't make me realize enlightenment.
Yeah.
I have to do it on myself. But it's very difficult when you read through some of the texts. So for example, I'm reading through this, the Venerable Children's Approaching the Buddhist Path right now.
Okay.
Each of the steps itself is very difficult to do if you want to observe further. And then that's it. And therefore, I don't see, I can't envision myself leading to that enlightenment because it really seems very, very hard. So compared with, it's quite related to the previous question. I don't want to talk about other religion, but it seems to be involved that. Other religions, it seems that once you believe in them, you go to heaven directly. But of course, you do need to attend churches, service, and do good things. But once you believe, you enter into the gateway of heaven. But this one, I find it very hard. So how do I start stop myself from, like, right now it's up, then I can go down again and then get discouraged and give up.
Okay.
It's a very hard life. A very hard Buddhist life. The physical life is really very hard already. And the Buddhist life is just as hard. No joy yet.
Okay. You have to make it fun, you know. This is kind of the point. When you see someone like Ajahn Brahm, he's always cracking jokes, always having a good time. You know Ajahn Brahm? Yeah, so he's always having a good time. So this is the kind of the point. You have to make the path fun. This is kind of the thing about it. So you make it fun. And so if you come down to our monastery, for example, we often just laugh and have a good time, probably much more fun than you have at work, And we are at work, One of the famous stories that Ajahn Brahm tells, Ajahn Chah was Ajahn Brahm's teacher in Thailand. He was probably the most famous teacher in the 20th century, meditation master in Thailand, very, very famous, Ajahn Chah. And sometimes he would be extremely funny. He was so funny that his other monks, the monk that later on became the abbot of that monastery, sometimes he would just be rolling around on the ground, holding his tummy because he was laughing so hard. You don't find that in lay life. You only find that with monks, When did you last see someone, rolling around on the ground because they have so much fun? It's very rare. So you have to make it fun, and this is one of the things. And you have to make it light, not to make it too serious. Can you understand me all right? Okay. So what I have always seen, anyone who I have seen who is someone who's practiced the Dhamma for a long time, who's had success on the path, they are very light-hearted people. Ajahn Brahm is very light-hearted. He's always has something fun to say, always has something happy to say. And this is what this practice does. It makes you more and more light-hearted. It takes away some of the seriousness. It shouldn't be too serious. When you go on a meditation retreat, don't go on those retreats that are too strict because you're just going to suffer too much. Go on one where there's some flexibility. So if you don't feel like going to the meditation, you don't have to go to the meditation because sometimes it's just not the right time for you or whatever. So do things that brings happiness to the path. As you say, life is difficult enough already. You don't want to add to that difficulty by creating a bad spiritual path. So as for the other religions, the point really is, what is most realistic? Is it most realistic to kind of place your life in the hands of some God who may or may not be there? Or who may not care about you? Who knows what God cares about you? He's got 7 billion other people to look after. That's too many already. So you just want 7 billion and one. So for me, it has been far more realistic to have a teaching whereby you are in charge of your own life. You take charge of your life, and you don't leave it in somebody else's hands. Who knows who this God is anyway? The Christians say one thing about this God, the Muslims say another thing, some say he's angry, some say he's kind, it's all kind of weird ideas. Who actually is this God? Who is right about this anyway? It's too uncertain, it's too unreliable. Put things in your own hands, make something out of the spiritual path, and it's a far far more realistic approach to life as far as I'm concerned. You know when you're kind, if you really are kind, if you're coming from your heart, you feel good about yourself afterwards. Have you noticed that? Have you got a hard time hearing me? Yeah. If you are kind, yeah, if you are kind to someone, if you really come from a good heart, you do an act of kindness, how do you feel about yourself afterwards? You usually feel good about yourself, yeah. And this is really kind of one of the main insights into the idea of the spiritual path. That's why the whole spiritual path is founded on kindness, on sila, on character development. Because as you build up the kindness, as you do that a lot, you're building up your inner happiness at the same time. It's just learning how to be kind in the right way, not just as an automaton, as a robot, but actually building up the kind of the goodness, so you come from a good heart at all times. So it is built on natural principles that you can see working right here in your own life. That is what I believe in. And with effort, with practice, you start to see that it actually works that way. Have I even remotely answered your question? Or yeah, remotely. Only. Okay, good.
Thank you, Ajahn. Okay. So my question is regarding human beings. So I find that we are, like, why is human beings so impulsive and then reactionary? And then, like, we come up with, like, plastics, and then we blame now that, you know, plastics are, like, all around. And then we come up with social media, and then we blame social media. So then we become slaves to it. But why are human beings like that?
Yeah. Well, because of craving, right? Because of desire, that's why we're like that. So we have desires. We think we're going to create a world where we can satisfy our desires. That's what plastic is about. It's about kind of having something very accessible, easy to use, that's going to satisfy us, going to make us happy here. But everything we do has unintended consequences. And the unintended consequences are the problem. So we have plastic, and eventually have so much of it that we kind of you have these massive patches in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, so the size of France or whatever it is, just plastic everywhere. That is the problem. Same thing with social media. We think it's going to satisfy our cravings. And actually, we don't satisfy cravings. We create more cravings. We create more troubles. And actually, it leads to disasters rather than making us more happy here. So the thing, one of the problems by craving is that if you feed the craving, you usually get more craving. So that's why the Buddhist path is actually about gradually eliminating the craving. How do you eliminate the craving? And the answer is you have to find your happiness somewhere else. You have to find the happiness inside rather than outside. That's how you eliminate the craving. And when you find the joy in kindness and generosity in meditation practice, you're filling up this hole inside of you. Yeah, it's the kind of, why do we crave in the first place? The reason we crave is because we have a feeling of lack. We feel incomplete. So you want to fill up that incompleteness with external things. Get a nice relationship, have a kind of nice job, have all these kind of things in the world. But actually, it never works because the problem is internal. So you have to do something internally. And that's what the Buddhist path is about. And that's why mental development is the way to go, not developing external things. So that's why we are so stupid. Yeah. So, anyway. Anyone else want to say? Please feel free to add to what I say, you know, because I
thank you, Ajahn, for your teaching. Just have a question. How do we help someone who's a non-Buddhist facing their end of life? So how do we, you know, help them through the process? They know that they have a short time left.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so how do you
convert before it's too late? Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
No, that's what the Christians do. Don't do that. That's kind of, No. So the thing about dying is that you know, what you want to do, you want to help people to kind of move into the future in a happy way, and the way to do that is always to encourage them to kind of remember good things that happened in this life, so they feel good about themselves when they pass away. So, you know, if you are a friend, or if you are, for example, a friend of the family or whatever it is, and you can tell the people who are closest to this person who is dying that now is the time to remember the good things. So often we are so fault-finding. We see all the problems in life because we think that when you see the problems, we're going to develop, we're going to eliminate the problems and make the world better. We always focus on problems. But there's always a lot of good things to see in people's life, and often we forget that, and it's terrible. So at the very least, when people pass away, you say to the person, you know, if it is a family member, thank you, Dad, you know, I remember, and then remember specific things that this person did to you. Mum, you, all of these wonderful things that you did for me, I remember this. Wow, actually, the more I think about it, you've been a really good mum, actually. Yeah, and you kind of remember all of those beautiful things that happen in your life. And the person will realize that if you remember it, then surely there must have been really positive things. Otherwise, you wouldn't remember these things. So this is one of the things. And also to, when people are passing away, to give them space. You know, often people just want to be peaceful and quiet and just relax or whatever. Give them space. I don't know if you heard a story, Ajahn Brahm had this story of a nun who was ordained, she was Australian, but she was ordained in the Tibetan tradition in Australia. And she was so fed up with all these people coming to her room and crying, oh no, don't die. What do you mean? I can't, you know, I don't have any choice. I got to die. This is what's happening to me. So she had, when someone, Ajahn Brahm, came to see her, there was a sign on her door saying, no one allowed to come in, yeah, because it was fed up of all these people coming and kind of crying or whatever. And then on below the kind of no one can come in, it was except Ajahn Brahm, yes, okay, Ajahn Brahm can come in. And then Ajahn Brahm goes in, he tells a few jokes, yeah, cheers her up, and then, you know, everything is fine. So this is the thing, and one of the kind of nice things that Ajahn Brahm has done, I you notice it because they're so different from what everyone else does. He goes to funeral services, and sometimes he tells jokes at the funeral service. Have you seen that before? And actually, it works, yeah, because if you are used to that idea of there's no point in actually being too sad, yeah, you're kind of helping the person on. If people are attuned to that, and you tell a good joke, yeah, you've got to tell a good joke, right? It's got to be a little bit relevant to the topic, to dying. Then actually, if people crack up, people have a good time. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. So, but you need special powers to do that, yeah. So,
hello, Ajahn.
Hello.
Just now you led us through meditation. During the meditation, you actually put a lot of good thoughts into our mind.
Yeah.
I wonder how we can do that also in daily life. I thought it was very good because I don't remember my meditation, but I remember the good thoughts. Somehow I was thinking, yeah, is there something we can do about this in our daily life?
Sure, yeah. No, absolutely. This is one of the most important things about meditation, is actually to have that positive attitude, you know. So thinking in the right way is so important. So sometimes what you can do is you just, you know, do things like remembering the blessings in your life, yeah, the good things in your life. And often if you start counting them, there's a lot of good things happening in your life. And you count those and you feel, and then you actually start to feel happy. But because we so often focus on the negative things because we think we have to solve them, we forget about all the positive stuff. So sit back. Well, just the fact that you have time to sit there quietly by yourself, isn't that wonderful? Yeah, you have time. You have kind of 15 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour, whatever it is, just to sit quietly. Feel what a blessing that is. And then feel joyful because you have that opportunity to sit down quietly. That's a very skillful way of doing it. If you have a hard time remembering good things when you sit down, maybe because you're too tired or whatever, you can use a guided meditation. It can be very useful. Because the idea of a guided meditation, one of the main points is to put you in the right mood for meditation practice. Yeah, and that, because it can be very hard by yourself, but when you kind of are in a group and you have a meditation teacher you trust or whatever, he can put you in that mood which is required through whatever instructions are given. That is another way of doing it. But very, even more powerful is if you can do it yourself. Remember the blessings in your life. Remember the you are practicing the Dhamma. It means you're heading in the right direction. Yeah, you're moving in the right direction. Someone came to me today, someone who's suffering from cancer. And sometimes very traumatic to get really sick like that, and then possibly, you know, don't know what's going to happen next stage. But if you have a spiritual practice, if you are going somewhere, if you are kind of going gradually upwards, then all these things like illnesses, even dying, is just a hiccup on that upwards path. When you can think of dying as just a little hiccup on the general path upwards, then you have really made it, yeah? Because then dying doesn't really seem so bad anymore. It's just a small little blip on the general movement upwards. So this is kind of a way of being very positive about life, yeah? Is that you kind of, you have this feeling, yes, I'm heading in the right direction. I'm going upwards in the right way here. And sometimes the sitting down and just feeling that you are free of so many burdens right now for this half an hour. Let everything go, let everything be. All I have is me and my breath. Yeah? Wow, how so simple, so nice. Yeah? Simple life is actually a really good life. So in these ways, just again, you know, you just kind of bring up whatever positivity is there. There's always so much positive to focus on. You just have to kind of remember it and at the right time. Yeah. Okay, good.
Last topic before we do some meditation. Or question, last question.
I'm looking from the other side. We call it desire. Desire is a bit of negative, I think.
Depends what you desire, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Since you say that, my question is how the desire can help us to break the bad habit.
How desire can help to break desire? Is that what you're saying?
No, yeah. We have a bad habit. I'm talking habit in English word.
Yeah. But desire.
Many of us have we call it habit.
Yeah.
But okay, good habit, fine. It's no need to discuss. But when we have a bad habit, how we can stop? How to break that?
Yeah. Sure.
Bad habit.
Yeah.
Do you think desire can help? In what way? That is my question.
Sure, I understand the question. I was just messing around because desire is a bad habit. So how can you use desire to break desire? Yeah, that's what that was kind of my point. But anyway, so yes, and actually there is a sutta on that. The sutta on everything. This is what I like to always point out, that everything, all of these things have answers in the suttas. The Buddha has always spoken about this. Because one of the, I don't know if you know, there's one of the sets of teachings called the Idipadas, which means like the steps to spiritual power or whatever. Yeah, one of the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, which are the 37 qualities on the side of awakening or something like that. And one of these is called the Chanda Idipada, and that is the desire, yeah, that is required to kind of give rise to samadhi and give rise to wholesome state. So you actually use desire, right kind of desire, gets you in the right direction, yeah? So, for example, if you want to meditate, you have to desire to do it. If you don't desire to do it, it's not going to happen. So that is good desire, yeah? You have to desire to sit down on your bottom and just watch your breath, otherwise it's not going to happen. So right desire is really the desire to practice the spiritual path, the desire to be kind, the desire to be to do all the right things, to listen to the Dhamma, to do the teachings. And if you do practice the Noble Eightfold Path and the spiritual path, one of the consequences of that is that the bad qualities will go down. Yeah, this is one of the consequences, including desire. Desire itself will gradually go down. So all you have to do is to desire practicing the spiritual life. That will cause all the bad things to go down as a consequence, including desire itself, until desire is completely overcome. And then the desire to overcome desire will also be overcome. Yeah? Because no need to have that desire anymore, because you already overcome it. So, so that's really all you have to do. Yeah, so but it's good to have a little bit of attachment to kindness. It's good to have a little bit of attachment to keeping the five precepts. If you haven't got any attachment to it, you're not going to do it. Yeah, because why? Well, because sometimes the desire, forget about that. You know, I really have to do this. You know, tonight everyone is going out drinking. I need a drink as well. So, you know, who cares? And so you have to have a little bit of attachment to the five precepts or to any kind of thing. And then you will have success eventually. Anyway, nice to see you here again. I'm very, very happy to see you coming every year. That's good. Well, he has worked with a Norwegian company, so we know each other really here quite well. That's why it's really cool. Okay, shall we do a little bit of meditation together? Is that nice? What I thought we could do, Eileen, is do some meditation until maybe 5 minutes to midnight. And then we can do maybe some forgiveness, because we forgive the past year. And then we'll do a bit of chanting to at the very last minute when we get into midnight. Is that a good idea? So we'll do some metta meditation first of all, to get in the right mood. Then we'll do the forgiveness, then we'll do the metta chant afterwards. Okay, good. So if you approve, yeah? I know it. I know it. You just listen. I will do it, yeah. Okay, so just sit back and relax and let's do some meditation.